This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome one and all to LNL on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia, and through our various online environments. And we're about to do a Coles to Newcastle Act. We're going to re-import a great American thinker to our American listeners, Alvin Toffler, writer, futurist, arguably the most influential of all futurists, and all of Alvin's writings over the past 40 years and more has concerned the collision of technology with the human race. It was back in the 60s that he started identifying some of the anxieties we were experiencing as we stepped away from agrarian cultures and towards the technological. Alvin and Heidi Toffler co-wrote Future Shock in 1970, it seems only yesterday, about this new information-heavy world. And each decade after that, they've produced another book describing the impact of the new cultures, information rich versus information poor, the potential for creating peace from the same technologies that manufacture war, and about someone called the prosumer as opposed to the consumer. And we'll introduce you to prosumers shortly. Alvin and Heidi Toffler's latest book is called Revolutionary Wealth. It's published by Knopf, and I'm joined now by Mr. Toffler. Unfortunately, Heidi can't be with us today. This completes a majestic trilogy, doesn't it? Future Shock, Third Wave, Revolutionary Wealth. Is there anything in your past writings, Alvin, that you've needed to, disregard or correct?
Sure. Oh, of course. Look, nobody knows the future with certainty, and anybody who claims to is probably a quack. We look at the great forces at work on our society. We draw some conclusions from that. In general, I think the record is we've been right about most of the things we've forecast. But, of course, we make mistakes. My favorite example is we wrote about cloning animals and cloning humans. We wrote that in 1970. That's 35 years ago, and it is 25 years before the first animal was in fact cloned. So that was correct. But along with it, we said that probably would happen by 1985, and it didn't for another two decades. So the question is, why are we so wide of the mark on the when we were correct on the what? And the answer is, we didn't make up that number. We didn't have a crystal ball. We talked with a leading Nobel Prize-winning biologist. And that was his assessment of what he thought it was going to happen.
Let me put to you one of your own questions. Is the decades-long drive towards re-globalization pausing briefly for breath, or is it about to suddenly go into reverse once more?
Well, that's a really good and powerful question. We point out in Revolutionary Wealth that we don't believe that history moves in straight lines, that it just keeps doing what it's been doing. And we don't think that just because China has been growing so rapidly, it's going to continue to grow that rapidly. And the same thing we feel about what we call reglobalization. Most people are not aware that there was a very strong globalization effect that was present in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, 1900s. And indeed, the world economy was pretty well integrated because the Brits were imperial masters of 85% of the world. And then everything went backwards. War broke out, 1914, 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, 1930, the Great Depression, World War II. All of these things broke up the economic integration that had previously been building up. And I don't believe that we're free of forces that could, in fact, reverse, to some degree, the current attempted reglobalization. There are lots of economic signs of instability out there, and any one of a number of things, including non-economic, but, you know, military effects and so on, that could send globalization in the economic sector backward again.
It's also lumpy, isn't it? Because as Weingarten of the Whitehall Financial Group reminds us, globalization marks sharply different rates of change. Currency markets, truly global, bond markets lag, stock markets, in the main, continue to list largely domestic securities.
Right. Exactly, exactly. But given all of that, the question is, the usual argument is globalization is going to continue or it's not. And my sense of it is, and our sense of it is, that economically it could go backward, but that there are so many issues emerging now that are not essentially economic. They all have economic implications, but they're questions of pollution crossing borders, questions of possible illnesses or pandemics crossing borders, international crime, international drugs, drug business, and so forth and so on. None of these can be handled by individual nations. And so there will be strong pressures for globalization or some form of globalization to deal with these kinds of issues, even if the economic integration begins to break down.
Here's another piece of Toffler for Toffler. The master, and you wrote this in 1993 for Wired, the master conflict of the 21st century will not be between cultures, but between the three super civilizations, between agrarianism, industrialism, and post-industrialism.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about having started as hunters and gatherers. One of the greatest revolutions in human history was simply the invention of agriculture. And that was probably done by a woman, we don't know for sure, but probably by a woman someplace in what is now Turkey.
Mm.
And somebody discovered that you didn't just pick what nature grew, but you could in fact make nature do what you wanted by growing things, planting them. And that launched a wave of change that moved slowly, slowly, slowly from the Middle East across to Northern Europe, for example, at a rate of 1 kilometer a year for 10,000 years.
And now in Revolutionary Wealth, you talk about how tomorrow's wealth will be created and how we should understand that it's not just about money, that not everything can be understood in terms of industrial age economics.
That is one of the main theses, a key thesis of this book. We believe that what we commonly, popularly call economics, and what economists call economics, is basically half, or only a piece, of the real larger wealth system. How the human race makes wealth is divided basically into two parts. One is one involves money, and that is what economists study. Basically, they study the transfer of money from pocket to pocket, the creation of economic value, but always measured in terms of money, and basically ignore the fact that all of us do things in our private lives without paying for something or without expecting to be paid for something. We participate in activities that create value, and many of those activities affect the money economy but are largely ignored.
I'm fascinated by this area because, this little anecdote, Gorbachev invited Ralph Nader and a friend of mine, Barry Jones, to the Soviet, to Russia, mm-hmm. as it was collapsing, to teach Russians to complain. He recognized that you needed a culture of complaint if you were to get people to lift their games. Gorbachev invites you to go to Russia to teach them about NGOs. You introduced, I believe, the first non-government organization to Russia.
The first one since the Russian Revolution. So I think it was 1986. And that's true, but of course Heidi and I did not do that alone.
Well, it was a remarkable group: Arthur Miller, James Baldwin, Peter Ustinov, etc.
Yeah. It was a small group, about a dozen of us, maybe 15 of us, and we were invited. We were never told why they invited us. They just simply said, we want to have a conference, and we'd like you to speak. And each person, we all flew out. There was a really funny story because at that time, U.S.-Soviet relations were ice cold. and it was and they had just arrested an American journalist on grounds of spying, and they had just released him a week or two before we went, and so we had that in mind when they invited us to come, and the amusing part of it is Aeroflot, the Russian airline, sent us a ticket one way.
Well, you were very courageous to climb on an Aeroflot flight in any case. So what did you leave behind you, though, after you've made this trip?
Yeah, the story goes like this. We meet for a week, and we're meeting in a beautiful compound in what was then Kyrgyzstan and is now Kyrgyzstan, under the Tianshan Mountains. Beautiful, beautiful place. Very contemporary, lovely, glass and stainless steel and wood architecture. And we're each asked to give a speech, and we all do that. We're all interesting people, so that's fine. But there's no pattern to it. But at the end of the week, they say, you know, this has been so wonderful that we need to continue. We need to do it again next year. And they insisted. And at that point, the other thing is they'd asked us to sign a manifesto. And we had told them in advance, look, we're not politicizing this. We're not going to sign some manifesto against nuclear weapons in Europe or this, that, or the other thing. That's not why we're coming. But they kept writing all week long. They were working on a manifesto, working. And we would determine we were not going to be suckered into some political thing. Mm. On the other hand, on Friday, they come forth with their draft. And the draft says, the future is approaching, the 21st century is approaching, and intellectuals should help people prepare for it. That was the end of the whole thing. Well, that's, as we say, motherhood and apple pie.
Yes.
That's no problem. We can slide that.
Yeah.
But I said, but there's one more sentence that it needs. And that sentence, and I wrote it out, and I said, that sentence is, and therefore, the people must have the right to debate, dissent, and disagree without fear. And they said, great idea. Great idea. They added it. At which point, all of us signed this document, and only then did they utter the word, okay, tomorrow we go see Gorbachev. We had never expected that.
Do you still have contact with him? He'll be in Australia in a couple of weeks.
I had some. It's been a few years now. But yes, in fact, we just sent him a copy of the new book, and I'm hoping he has a chance to react to it.
But to go back to this NGO principle of yours, as you point out, NGOs, volunteers, hobbyists, open source software programs, so many things are pumping free lunch into the economy.
Right, exactly. I just want to finish, though, the Gorbachev piece, because we figured out finally the reason they insisted that we had to meet again was that if we simply dropped it at this point, then we were merely a conference. But if we had a second one or a third one, we were an organization. And they wanted to form an organization which was not part of the Communist Party or part of the Soviet government. And that is what we did.
How marvelous. How marvelous. What's it called?
It was called the Issyckel Forum. That's Issyckel's a place. It's where we had one of our meetings. And so it was called the Issyckel Forum. And we indeed did meet a few times after that. Once there was a meeting in Switzerland, and then there was one in Mexico City, and then there was a 10-year version of that, which unfortunately we were not able to attend. So there was a continuing organization of sorts. But the main thing was to demonstrate that Russians, the Soviets, had the right to start organizations on their own. And it also became clear that this whole thing was a put-up job between that Gorbachev and a writer named Chingiz Aitmatov, which was he's a great writer, a great Russian writer, actually a Kyrgyz, they were pals, and they set up this deal, and the object was to illustrate to the Soviet people that they did not have to, that they were free now, to talk to each other without doing it through the party or the state.
Well, there you go. You thought I was being flattering when I said you've affected the future. You've certainly had an impact on it in Moscow and
well,
surroundings.
There's something like 350 or 400,000 NGOs in Russia.
One of the most elusive things about you, there, of course, are truckloads of websites that talk about you. There's piles of books. And, you know, we've been buried in information. But I've got to tell you, biodata about you and Heidi is elusive. So can we just whiz through this? When did you meet? I understand it was at New York University.
Oh, I'd be happy to tell a story. The problem is people won't believe it because it's too corny. It's right out of a 1938 Hollywood film. We were both, I graduated from NYU in the fall of 1948. And this was election time in the United States, and it was a bitter election, and there were, it was still a time when black Americans were segregated and frequently prevented from voting. And I went down to, from New York, down to North Carolina to campaign, or to actually to knock on doors and register black voters. I went with a couple of black guys, and there was a larger group of us going down to do that. And I faithfully did that for a few weeks. But at the end of a few weeks, I had dirty laundry. Well, what does a 19-year-old male do when he's got dirty laundry? He says, I got to take it home to mom, you know. I figured I'd take a weekend, go up north, leave the laundry at home, and then go visit the university, see if any of my pals were hanging around Washington Square outside NYU. And that is what I did. And I crossed Washington Square, which is sort of a campus for New York University, and saw a classmate of mine, a girl classmate of mine, and sitting next to her was this gloriously beautiful blonde. Well, I never got back to North Carolina.
Well, there should have been a Cruz Kidman movie about this, because the next thing, I love this story, but I've never quite understood what your motives were, is you, the two of you, move to the Midwest and you work on assembly lines.
Right.
What the hell was that about?
Well, that was of a piece with going south to register black voters. We were political activists, and we wanted to help unions organize the workers, and so that's what we did. And we worked for 5 years on assembly lines, or I became a millwright, the old-fashioned term for mechanic, in a steel foundry, and Heidi became a union shop steward in an aluminum foundry. And the other thing she did, which I will always bless her for, was a shop steward, but she also was head of the union's recreation committee. And once a year they had an event, and they usually went to a picnic in the summer. And she said, why don't we go swimming in the municipal pool? And black workers said, we're not allowed to. And that's something you do not say to my wife.
Mm.
And she, of course, not alone, and certainly led by blacks, but with the blacks, went to that pool and desegregated. They went en masse to that municipal swimming pool, and the desegregation sign came down and never went back up.
That's a great story. And it has, well, this adventure of yours has strange results, because suddenly you're a columnist on labor matters for Fortune. And IBM are on the blower, aren't they, asking you to write about social organizational impact of computers?
Yeah.
Why weren't you deemed to be dangerous radicals by...
Because half the staff of Fortune magazine were ex-dangerous radicals. That's what the editor said to me when I fessed up to all of this.
Well, where does your radicalism come from, Alvin? Was it family? Was it dynastic? Is it...
No, I think it came out of World War II. It came out of watching some guy named Hitler wanted to destroy us, and it politicized me at a very, very young age. At age 10, I was reading the New York Times stories about the Spanish Civil War.
Mm. And Heidi, what kindled her political passions?
Well, I think we both discovered them at the same time, more or less.
Right.
Together.
And heavens above, you're still married after all these millions of years.
And it's a tribute to incessant argument.
Well, you love an argument. This is LNL on ABC Radio National. It's Radio Australia, downloadable onto your MP3 player through ABC Online. And my guest is none other than Alvin Toffler, writer, futurist, and we're talking on the occasion of his new book, Ian Hyde's new book, Revolutionary Wealth. Now, back in the 70s, you talked to the US Senate about what you perceived to be the power of non-government organisations. We've talked about your influence in the Soviet. How important are they at this moment as an energiser and as an influence in economic outcomes around the world?
I think NGOs are enormously important, and that they're multiplying at a phenomenally rapid rate. And more than just simply multiplying, they're forming temporary networks of various kinds at the local level, the state level, and the global level, and that they are going to continue to be more and more important in the way societies are organized. And that I think on the whole is a good thing, although NGOs can be good, bad, or indifferent.
Sure, yeah. I'd like you now to educate me, because I don't know a damn thing about open source software, but it's a very important ingredient in your argument.
Yeah, the main argument that we make is that alongside the money economy, as I said before, there is a virtually invisible second economy in which people do things without pay, which then have a big impact on the money economy. And the perfect example is that of Linux. Here's a guy, a young geek in Finland, probably in a cubicle somewhere, and he's working, I guess, for some official agency or company, and he doesn't like the software on his computer. He thinks it's klutzy, and he could actually write better software, operating system for his computer. So he goes off on his own when he's not working for money, and without money, proceeds to, I suppose, play with it and start drafting an alternative operating system for the computer. And lo and behold, he writes one, and it's better than what he's got on the machine. And what he does with it, instead of selling it, is he simply puts it out on the web.
He's a secular saint, isn't he, Alvin?
And some people regard him as kind of the Martin Luther of software, you know, or the reformer. And so he puts it out on the web, and lo and behold, hundreds of software writers, maybe thousands, I don't know by now, begin to add things to it, to improve it further, to add functions. And pretty soon you have a very powerful system, and Microsoft is running scared of it, because more and more people and companies are adopting it. Not only that, but companies then start producing products that work with it, and therefore further spread Linux. So here you have an individual and later a group of essentially volunteers devoting their own time and their own brain power to create a product, which is called Linux.
So what we have on the one hand are non-government organizations, and here we've got a non-corporate organization.
It's a non-corporate.
An NCO.
Yeah, it's not even an organization in that sense. It's a kind of a temporary, fast-changing network of people.
Yeah.
But in any event, probably has spawned some organizations. I'm sure has spawned some organizations as well. And what you have is a powerful piece of software so important that China, for example, has announced that government agencies in China must use Linux instead of Microsoft, and undoubtedly enjoying giving the finger to Microsoft and a little bit to the U.S.
Well, that's a splendid story.
There's a powerful example of somebody, of people doing things without remuneration, no compensation, therefore not looked at, by and large, by economists,
yeah,
until such time as it affects the money economy.
And now, people sort of walking in your footsteps, but not necessarily understanding what you're on about, often equate knowledge with oil, but you make a very powerful point that the difference is that the more knowledge we use, the more we create, as opposed to oil, because the more we use it, the less we have.
Right, exactly. And look, you can use arithmetic, I can use arithmetic, we don't use it up. So ideas, information, is essentially inexhaustible. Maybe in some universal sense there's an end, but for all practical purposes, it's inexhaustible. And that's the key resource of the emergent economy.
You've never been profoundly pessimistic, have you? You've always had a strong streak of optimism.
Well, there are plenty of things to worry about and be, you know, scared silly about. I grant you that. But I don't know where this streak of optimism comes from. I think it's from being an American. I think it's
yes, it comes in the water, doesn't it, really?
It comes in the chemistry, yeah.
Your collective DNA. I've got to ask you something in parentheses that I don't really understand. Here's this fire-breathing radical going around enfranchising African-Americans and causing trouble on the assembly line, and you're a great mate of Newt Gingrich.
Yes. Why is that? And there's a good reason for that. There are several good reasons for that. Heidi and I have known Newt Gingrich from before he was in politics. He was just a professor in a small town university, basically, or a suburban university. And he came to hear me speak in Chicago for the American Council on Education after Future Shock came out. And this was some guy with bell-bottom trousers and long hair and just another hippie, as far as visually was concerned. And I sort of said hi, and I shook hands, and that was the end of that. But 2 years later, no, 5 years later, I suppose, we were asked by members of Congress to put on a day or day and a half conference on the future in the U.S. Senate building. And so we set out to do that, and we and some other futurists began getting together a list of names of speakers and so forth and so on. But we took a good look at it and said, they're all Democrats, and we're talking to both parties. So who should we get? And somebody said, well, there's this professor down in Georgia, and it turned out to be Newt. And
it has to be one of the most unfortunate names, I think.
Well,
Newt.
Well, it's wait a minute, it's over half of Newton.
You know? Okay.
But in any event, so he came, and we got to know each other then. And he is, Heidi and I have stayed up to the limits of the night, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, fighting, arguing, shouting with him about individual political positions. But as a person, he is warm, he is brilliant, and he does something no other politician we have ever met. And I've covered the White House, and I've covered the Congress as a journalist. I've never met anybody who came close who, when you say, why don't we do X, whether the welfare system or the pension system or the tax system or whatever, he will say, and this is not fake, it's not a put-on, it's just the way he thinks, he'll say, what would that look like in 30 or 40 years?
Right.
You know anybody else who says that?
I have to say that it's a name that's always had me crossing, you know, making the sign of the cross and saying unclean, unclean. So yeah. I'll have to rethink Gingrich now.
No, he is extremely intelligent, and he is obviously extremely articulate as well. And the other quite separate thing is there are personal reasons why we became close with him, because he knew my daughter before she died, and she called him Uncle Newt, and he was just. He and his wife at that point were very, very sweet to her.
Well, things like that, of course, overwhelm every other argument,
exactly.
Don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, tell me, in the interest of balance, do you have a cordial relationship with Al Gore, who seems to be coming back from the political grave?
Well, the answer is no, we haven't, although we would welcome one. But the answer is no. On the other hand, there's a connection between Newt and Gore that most people are quite unaware of. After this conference we put on in the Congress in 1975, it was, we were then asked to help them create something called the Congressional Clearinghouse on the Future, which is essentially, and I think it's still operating there, which is essentially a, as we call it, a caucus, a group of either party, and they bring in futurists to speak to members of Congress, basically. And the two leading figures who were interested in that and who I think at some point or another led it, one was Newt and one was Gore. Mm. And they know each other, of course, and they both are future-oriented.
Sure. That's why I raised the gore issue, because, of course, he's now marketing himself through the movie on the rather apocalyptic movie on climate change.
Right. He's all over Wired magazine and so on. I think he and Newt could privately sit down and have a good laugh and a good chat.
Alvin, I've been dealing with Australian governments for 30, 40 years and have never found them to be particularly good at long-term thinking. You know, the next poll, the next election is about the time frame. Do you see much evidence of good futurist thinking in the current White House as opposed to your friend Gingrich?
In the White House?
Yeah, in the administration.
Let's put it this way. I've heard more futurist rhetoric from the White House. I think there is to a... Well, the White House is different because, first of all, you've got 4 years. Certainly twice what you have in Congress for before you face re-election. But I do think that this guy, this Bush, for whom I did not vote, I didn't vote for Kerry either, I do think he does think about the future. Not sure I like the way he thinks about it all the time, but he does in his own way. And I think at least the rhetoric coming from the White House, if you counted the words, the frequency of the word future or some other word meaning the same thing, if you counted the words in the official rhetoric of the White House, I think you'd see a lot more than you did in previous ones.
I don't want to invade your privacy, but you have established who you didn't vote for. So, who did you vote for?
I didn't vote. I didn't vote for president.
Oh, right. Okay. You didn't. You didn't go for a third party candidate or anything as eccentric as that. No. I think I should briefly interrupt the flow of conversation to remind all and sundry that this is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod, and that my guest is Alvin Toffler. Look, so much for futurology in the White House. Do you detect a great interest in the future in China?
Absolutely. I think they are fixated by it now. If we're talking about the leadership and the leader class in China, I think that's definitely true. And I think that
it's not just rhetoric this time. You think that there's some good, hard ideological thinking and planning?
No, I think there is. I think there definitely is. Whether it's good or bad is another matter. Whether it's good for you, Australians, or for us Americans, or for the world, these are separate questions. But I do think they think ahead. And there's a kind of history in all of that. And they also are, whereas the Europeans, for example, are very either hostile to or very suspicious of technology, by and large, culturally. I think the Chinese eat it up alive. They're technophiliacs. And I think that that links into having a long-range future view as well. So... I do believe, yes, they are, and they're pressing forward. Now, I also said, as I think I said earlier on another occasion, I don't believe in straight-line history. Mm. Things just don't continue going in straight lines. And the fact that China has been growing as rapidly as it has is not any guarantee that it will continue to do so without tremendous ups and downs in the years immediately ahead.
And, of course, it's also virtually an unprecedented experience in that you've got the free market and the command economy in a very strange double act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and it's very messy. And there's lots of internal unrest, which I think will escalate. But at the same time, if you think that raising human beings out of poverty is a good idea, then I think we have to take our hats off to the Chinese over the past few years, the success of the Chinese in moving very, very large numbers of Chinese into a better life.
You've got a good chapter in Revolutionary Wealth on Japan, Japan's next bamboo ring. How do you rate them?
Well, I just returned from there. In fact, I'm still suffering the jet lag from the return trip. I just spent a week in Tokyo. And I think that they've got to get their act together. Either they're going to have to make some big changes, or they're going to find themselves rather disappointedly falling behind their customary position of importance. Now, are they capable of it? I think they are. I think they are. And I'll tell you, apart from all the officials one talks to and the interviews with the media and the press and all the rest of that, I went to Akiba the other day. Akiba is a shorthand term for Akihabara, which was from the very beginnings of the computer, the sort of electronic alley where you went to buy the first PCs. And I remember Heidi with a collaboration with Japanese NHK produced a television documentary based on our book, The Third Wave, and we shot in Akihabara. And there, you know, there were people going to stores and so forth, and they had the latest electronics at that time. But I was there last week, and I swear you couldn't cross the street without being swallowed up by hundreds and hundreds of people crossing the street at the same time. It was shoulder to shoulder, like a massive crowd. And who were they? They were young. They looked like they were in their late teens or early 20s. Mostly, well, they were not hippies, by and large. They seemed to be reasonably well-dressed and, you know, shirts and trousers and so on. And they were just eating up that entire neighborhood. So, and at the same time, we also know that there's a whole hippie-esque, kind of post-hippie-esque movement among young Japanese as well. So these kids are not going to be the same as their current leaders or their grandparents. And
They may be another one of these bamboo rings you talk about. And I should point out to the listener, it's sometimes said that Japan is like bamboo. It grows in long, straight sections of a green trunk, periodically marked by a narrow grey-brown ring. And you see the straight sections symbolising Japan's resistance to change and the rings representing sudden and revolutionary upheaval.
Right, right. Now, you also have external factors that can shake up the entire relationship, and that is the North Korean threat, if shooting missiles near your country is a threat, and some concern about China's geopolitical moves as well. So there are external factors that are going to, I think, shake Japan. There is a worrying degree of nationalism rising, which I did not personally encounter, but apparently is present among some young people, and also a campaign by the extreme right to promote nationalism in the schools.
Well, there's another paradox, Alvin, isn't there? Because one of the alleged properties, qualities, inevitabilities of globalization is a blurring of national identity, religious identity. In fact, around the world, the opposite almost seems to be happening.
Yes, I think it is. And I think that's perhaps because we have had rather naive ideas about globalization. You know, one big happy planet. And you can leave that for Hollywood, some science fiction film. But I think that we are seeing an outbreak of nationalism. However, nationalism, as I see it, indeed the nation as such, is really a product of the Industrial Revolution. You had states, and you had monarchies, and you had all kinds of systems before. But if you regard a nation as I think of it as an integrated economy and an integrated coextensive political system. If these two things are present, you have the makings of a nation.
But therefore, by your definition, you've got nations forming on the net.
You have the equivalent of all kinds of forms on the net. I mean, it's like watching, you know, I just saw a movie on the flight back from Tokyo about a kid who loved to study insects. And they had some fantastic blow-ups on the full screen of a wide variety of insects. And when you look at the different structures of these creatures, how varied they are and how unlike. Architects build buildings, but they don't look interesting. They look like they're all the same.
Yeah.
But these insects are incredibly structured, with some of them have long legs that bend in certain ways and so forth and so on. I think that that's what we're going to see, an explosion of new ways of organizing people to get things done.
And perhaps we'll have different shaped legs as well once we start genetically modifying.
Well, we may even do that, who knows? But even if we don't literally do that to our bodies, we will, I think, do that to our institutions. Because the institutions that come with the nation and the nation state is basically... By the way, if you talk to the foreign policy experts, they will inevitably refer to the Treaty of Westphalia, 1638, as the basis of the nation state, because that treaty, after the 30 Years' War in Europe, killed everybody in sight. The leading remaining princelings got together and said in that document that we must not interfere in each other's territory. So there was going to be sovereignty. Of course, not many people today have read the Treaty of Westphalia.
I must admit, I haven't read it lately, Alvin.
Well,
no.
I think not many people have, but I did by chance about a year ago. And let me tell you something. It is not about sovereignty. 95 or 99% of the Treaty of Westphalia is about real estate and who's going to get which pieces of it. And then there's a throwaway line about independent sovereignty. But we have, ever since then, built the nation on the assumption that it would be an independent unit and that no other nation had a right to interfere in its internal affairs. And that has had some usefulness for the human race, I suppose. But the fact is, we now live in an increasingly interconnected reality in which it's impossible to close off your borders, and not just your geographical borders, your cultural borders, your informational borders, your medical borders even, and so on.
Yeah. Going back to a phrase of yours I quoted earlier, knowledge is essentially inexhaustible. It seems to me that so are you and Heidi. How do you keep it up? I mean, are you on drugs or something?
No. Well, on medications that doctors occasionally persuade us to take, but
it's a fair question. How do you maintain the pace after damn near half a century of doing this?
Well, let's start with this: minimizing exercise. But in fact, we're very fortunate. Look. We were not rich kids. We hit oil with the publication of Future Shock. We live very nicely in a place that we love. We have some help and good people, and we are lucky. And we're asked to travel around the world.
And you also have a sense of humor, Alvin, which I think is a huge help, isn't it?
Well, I don't think we could survive happily for 48 hours of our lives without some good jokes passing. Yeah.
This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, downloadable onto your MP3 player through ABC Online. And my guest is none other than Alvin Toffler, writer, futurist, and we're talking on the occasion of his new book, he and Heidi's new book, Revolutionary Wealth. The two of you are great phrase makers. We've dropped dozens of them in the course of our little chat. One of the terms you've created, and we mentioned it right at the outset, is to hell with consumers, prosumers. In the minutes we've got left, can you tell us about this conflation of the producer and the consumer?
Right. Yeah, and that is what we do when we paint our house. For example, prosumer is the phrase we coined to mean the combination of consumption and production. We consume what we ourselves produce, as distinct from the division between producer and consumer that current economics are based on. What we're seeing is more and more the involvement of customers. This is even in the money system. The inclusion and indeed growing reliance of companies on customers to give them ideas for new marketing devices, new models, this, that, and the other thing, or to perform acts for them like beta testing, software when it comes out, and so forth. People have always been prosumer because long before money was ever invented, people grew their own food, sewed their own clothes, sewed their own boots. Whatever they needed, they built their homes. They had to do by themselves because there wasn't a money system and an exchange system or a market system.
So the past will live again, at least in that sense.
In this sense, I think we're going to see an enormous increase in the involvement of consumers in the production functions. And the best example, the best example of it is that we're going to create new technologies that we will buy in the money economy that will help us prosume things and processes in the non-money economy and do it better than ever. A good example, if you go back far enough, go back 50 years, and you want to take pictures of your family, you clicked your camera, but you had to take the film into some store, which would then get it developed and printed. In the U.S., you took it to a drugstore, a pharmacy. They sent it to Rochester, New York, where Kodak had a huge factory, and what they did was develop and print the films and send it back to your local store. You then went into your local store, and you paid your money, and you got your pictures of your family. Well, now we have the technology produced in the money sector of the economy. It's called a digital camera. And you no longer need to pay somebody to develop and print. You are now developing and printing yourself inside the palm of your hand.
Yeah, and the same thing applies to dissemination of information. You don't have to go to a publisher to get a book published now. You can publish on the net.
Yes, you can, and more people do.
Yeah.
And so what you see is, what we think, is that we're going to see an explosion of additional technologies of one kind or another that encourage and make possible more and better prosuming by people doing things without having to buy them or buy the services of somebody else.
George Monbiot, who's an English writer, analyst, who we have on the program from time to time, says of the future that trade, international trade, may have a very bumpy road because of fuel prices, and he's arguing that there will be a return to regional food production and consumption because it'll be too bloody expensive to cart it around. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure that I would agree with the reason he gives, because we'll also have, I believe, all kinds of incredible advances in transportation and reduced costs and so forth and so on. But be that as it may, the other point he makes is very interesting and goes with considerable evidence that regions are, in fact, becoming more potent, more important players. If you read the work of Kenichi Omai in Japan, he's written a lot about this, I think written very well, about how more and more decisions are being made at a regional level, in China, for example, rather than at the central level. And I think that we're seeing a good bit of this regionalization, so that we don't just think in terms of town, city, state and nation, but that there are intermediate forms like regions. But there will be other kinds of connections as well. I don't see why we may not see, three states form an alliance I'm sure it happens now. They'll form an alliance to get some piece of legislation passed at the national level, or they'll build some kind of infrastructure to connect themselves in a certain way, independently of the national, any national interest.
I was talking about you being on the program earlier in the week, telling the listener that you were like an Old Testament prophet who keeps coming up with New Testaments. And I'm interested in how admired your work has been in, say, in France or in Italy, where you've been showered in awards. And I understand that the third wave is second only in sales to a work of Mao Zedong's in China. Are you a prophet who is honoured sufficiently in his own country? Are you as respected in the US?
Well, I hope we're respected, but there's a heck of a lot more competition. Not as, by the way, we don't regard ourselves primarily as futurists. We're writers. We're authors. That's what we do.
Yeah.
We happen to write about things that, and we basically come out of a kind of sociological background as distinct from a economic background, or we've had a lot of jobs, a lot of different kinds of jobs. We've been journalists as well. Wrote endless poetry when I was young.
Is that right? I didn't know about that.
And that has something to do with creating neologisms. And
look, I'm willing to extend this program over its normal length if you'll read us some poems.
I wouldn't even know where to look for them now.
Ah, there you go. You're being evasive. Well, none. Where are you politically now? Because there you were as a fire-breathing radical in your early days. Are political definitions meaningful to you now, or are they irrelevant?
I think they're a dying form in our present institutional structures, and I'm disaffected. Now, there are individual laws that ought to be supported and individual things that need to be done, and you know, we would favor some of those and oppose others, but let's put it this way. What I jokingly say frequently is I believe, economically speaking, I believe in the market 100%, but not 1,000%. They're obviously...
Oh, you're good at aphorisms. That's
But there are things that we need governments to do.
Yeah.
Because individual companies can. A really good example of that is if you didn't have government support, you would have very little long-range far-out research and development, because companies might not be able to afford to wait 10, 15, 20 years.
Well, you certainly need it for war, don't you?
Well, certainly for that.
Yeah.
But quite apart from that nasty thought, governments, I think, can do things that individual companies cannot do, and that individual markets might not provide things that individual markets cannot supply. And therefore, the idea that we should get rid of all government activity is nonsense to me. But at the same time, we've had really dreadful experiences, experiments with kind of top-down, either communist or socialist economies, and they just have a lousy record when it comes to producing wealth, let alone distributing it.
Well, you've given us a wealth of ideas, and I've enjoyed our chat enormously. I hope it hasn't been too taxing for you, Alvin, and I'm sorry that your wife's not feeling great today, but it's been a pleasure and a privilege. The book, Revolutionary Wealth, by the Tofflers, published by Knopf through Random House. And anything else you'd like to know about Alvin and Heidi's publications, their life, their work together, is on their website, alvintoffler.net. Thanks, Alvin.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. And thanks for the fun questions.
Okay.
Enjoyed it.
On our next, on Classic, each Friday night we open up the archives, and our next is an interview from 7 years ago with Peter Cundall, my own personal garden gnome. The Gladys, of course, know him as the ABC's most energetic gardener. He's also a great character and an old lefty. Thank you to the team. I'd like to acknowledge the immense efforts of Donna McLaughlin, Chris Short, Sasha Fegan, Sarah Konofsky, Paul Goff, Louis Mitchell, and even the executive producer Chris Bullock, who occasionally fronts to the office and does something. The news is next, and I'll talk to you later on.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.